This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. My guest is Sir Michael Lindsay Hogg, whose very interesting biography you can read on Wikipedia. He will be showing his paintings next month at BCB Art in Hudson. He's also well known as a director for stage, screen, and television. Before the interview, Mick Jagger in a live performance of Sympathy for the Devil from Rolling Stone's Rock and Roll Circus, and afterwards a live performance of Hey Jude by the Beatles.
We'll be right back. This is Richard Roth. I'm here with Michael Lindsay-Hogg at BCB Art in Hudson. Michael will be having an opening here in August. Meanwhile, he's visiting Hudson, where you recently, I think, bought a house?
Yeah, my wife and I bought a little house on Allen Street. We got to know the area pretty well over the years because our daughter went to Bard. And she graduated 5 years ago, but really for the last 8 or 9 years, we've gotten to know the Bard, Tivoli, Rhinebeck, Claverack, Hudson area. And we love it up here. We love it up here. So we've just got a little house. We're going to spend a lot of time there.
Now, do you live in New York?
Los Angeles. That's where my wife, Lisa, and I met. And for me, once we met, that's where I decided I was going to be. If she was there, I was going to be there. And because I direct movies sometimes when I can raise the money, Los Angeles, it's kind of like if you want to be in the car industry, you live in Detroit, well, at least in the old days. Now you probably live in Tokyo. But L.A. is a good place to live if you try to raise movie money, which is a slow and torturous process.
And movies were something you've been in since you were a very young child.
Movies and theater. My mother was an actress, Geraldine Fitzgerald, and she was under contract to Warner Brothers. Her first movie was Wuthering Heights with Laurence Olivier that she got an Academy Award nomination for. And so I was partly brought up in Los Angeles, but also out of the beach in Santa Monica. And then my mother remarried when I was 6, and then we moved to New York, where my stepfather, who's a businessman, lived. So currently it's Los Angeles and, you know, as much as we can be in Hudson. Jane went to Bard, and also she lives in New York now, even though she grew up in California. She lives in New York and is a very good sculptor, Jane Mosley. That's her dad's name, I'm her stepfather. She lives there, so we try to get into New York every few months to see her. And, of course, if we're up here in Hudson, we'll be able to see her much more, and she can come up and see us.
Recently, Bruce loaned me the DVD of your rock and roll circus. And I must say, that was a fantastic... I haven't seen it personally. I saw Let It Be back in the day. Mm. That must have been quite an experience putting that together.
The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, yeah, it was. It's become a sort of an historic document, film, of a particular time in the history of popular music. The show was really put together by Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones, and me. We wanted to have a venue where musicians that the Rolling Stones admired could come and play, and we'd all do the show. So we had The Who, we had Taj Mahal, we had Marianne Faithfull, and we had a super group, which was John Lennon, Eric Clapton, Mitch Mitchell, the drummer from the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and Keith Richards playing bass for them. And also joining in for another number was Yoko Ono, who gives what I can only call a startling performance. And then the Rolling Stones.
A whole lot of Yoko.
A whole lot of Yoko going on.
This was fairly early on in John and Yoko's relationship.
Yeah. She's been a sort of much maligned person over the years because she came into John's life and the Beatles' life at a very tricky point for them, the Beatles, that is. But she was a well-known artist in New York in the late 50s. She was older than John. She was 6 or 7 years older. And she had her own career as a conceptual artist in New York in the late 50s. And when she came to London, she went on with her art, and John met her at a show. And it was at a time, I think, when John was looking to evolve away from just being a Beatle and a pop star. He and Paul, who were like brothers, they started writing together when they were 15 or 16, had different paths they wanted to go on. Paul's was always to have a kind of secure, stable, what I'd call middle-class life with its sense of order. And he had a very long and happy marriage to Linda and had 3 kids with her and also his Linda's daughter from a previous relationship. And that's the world that Paul wanted. He wanted order and he wanted stability because that's the way he could create. John was looking, I think, for something much more bohemian. He was looking almost for a world of influences coming into him which he'd catch and look at and do something with. And sort of a stable world was a world he probably didn't recognize. And so Yoko was the perfect woman for him. And when we were doing Let It Be, which was the Beatles' last movie, the documentary, which is going to come out again, I think Apple's going to release it probably in two years or more. Till we see it again. And people, you know, often say, well, did Yoko broke up the Beatles? Because it was the first time there were more than four people sitting in the magic circle, and because she was always by John's side. But they were pretty much ready to break up anyway, especially by the time we were doing Let It Be, because it was like a young marriage. They'd all been together since they were in their teens, and Ringo joined a bit later. And they'd been through so many tumultuous experiences and had learned so much about the world and about each other. They were then looking to go their separate ways, I think. Because by the time we did Let It Be, the songwriters, principally John and Paul and George, were writing separately. They weren't sort of writing collaboratively anymore. And so whatever written the song would come in and play it through, give the chord changes to the others. And it was really like a songwriter with sidemen. And although they knew each other's voices and harmonies and styles of playing, you know, since they were kids, it really was songwriter, and here's what you're going to do, and that's where Paul was working, and to a degree George was and John was. And so the collaboration, which had been so profound when they were young, really was altering its dynamic. And so Yoko was there because John loved her, and she protected him in a way which he sort of needed. But it wasn't her. They were going to break up. So,
were you living in that world socially in those days? I mean, it seems, were you having directed these the Stones and the Beatles, that you must have had some kind of connections with them?
I got lucky when I was young. I always liked rock and roll music. I'd gone to school in New York, high school, and I'd always try to get home in the afternoon in time to watch Dick Clark's American Bandstand. The first time I ever heard Elvis Presley, I thought, finally, there's music in the world for me. And then through a series of changes in my life, I went to Oxford University for a year. I mean, mainly only for a year because I didn't pass any exams. And then I went to work in Ireland in Irish television for 3 years. And then I found myself, when I was 24, directing this English rock and roll show called Ready, Steady, Go, which was a live show on the air every Friday night, which went on for 45 minutes. And it was an extraordinary time to be in England and to be directing rock and roll television. We discovered The Who. The Rolling Stones were on every time they were in London. Regularly, The Kinks, The Yardbirds, Dusty Springfield, and then the visiting Americans, Roy Orbison, The Supremes, The Everly Brothers, The Miracles, Nina Simone, whoever we had on the show. And unlike some of the other television shows of the period which had popular music on them, the other shows really tried to present the music in a very tidy way, kind of a nice establishing shot, and then a bit tighter, and then a close-up, and then back to the establishing shot again. And they tried to push away the chaos which rock and roll was bringing into the world. And by that I mean something really unruly. Whereas on Ready, Steady, Go, we embraced the unruly. We had cameras in shot. We had sometimes a camera flub would be good, and then we'd repeat it on a song a little bit later. We invented things to do with zoom lenses, to make pulsing, to make the music visually as exciting as it was orally, AU. And consequently, the bands which were on the show and the bands which watched it, by the time I was doing Ready, Steady, Go, the Beatles were too important to do live television. It was too much of a hassle. The bands which were on it and the people which watched it liked it a lot because they thought it really caught the mood of the times. And so that's why when the Rolling Stones wanted to do their first video, which was in 68, which was Jumping Jack Flash and B-side Child of the Moon, they asked me to do it. And I'd already worked with the Beatles in 66 on Paperback Writer in Rain. And so, but in 1968, I'd done the Stones doing their first video, and then the Beatles asked me to do Hey Jude and Revolution. I mean, it's a pretty good pair, you know. It's Jumping Jack Flash and Hey Jude and Revolution. I felt lucky. And then Mick Jagger asked me to come up with this idea for what became the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And I didn't have an idea at first. We had a date. We had a studio date. And we were thinking of what bands we wanted to have on the show. We wanted to have a new band, give some of a break. And we chose out of a lot of demos and things, Jethro Tull. But we turned down as a new band Led Zeppelin, which is a mistake. I think Mick thought they were too heavy on the guitar. Or maybe he didn't want to. Maybe he thought they were too tough. But so we didn't have Led Zeppelin. We had Jethro Tull, who gave a great performance. But I didn't have an idea for the show, and the date, and the December dates for the studio were there. They were fixed because everyone was free in those days. And so after several weeks, I was nervous about what the show was going to be, and I was in the Rolling Stones offices in London, and I was doodling on a pad, and part of my doodle was a circle, 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 circle. And so I thought, and sort of it just came into my head a title, which was the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And I thought as a title, it had all the ingredients which sort of was a savor of what the show might be. Rolling Stones, that was good. Rock and Roll, that was good. And Circus gave this sense of a place where everyone would come and have a good time. So I called Mick up with some relief and said, I think I've got the show. And he said, yeah, what is it? And I said, I'm just going to say, what is it, 7 words to you, Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And immediately got it. So we did the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which was a pretty hectic event. And while I was preparing that, I got a call from Paul McCartney asking me to come and talk to them because they were interested in doing a sort of television special. And you can imagine, I was then 28, 3 years older than Mick, I'm the same age as John Lennon would have been. I did feel enormously, almost honored to be asked by these two bunch of people who I admired enormously.
Giants of the time.
Giants of the time, and they've lasted. I mean, every time you hear a Beatles song on the radio, you think, boy, that's really good. And the Rolling Stones, as you know, are still out there. They still are touring, you know, making billions of dollars. But they're, you know, I don't know where they are today. They're in Australia or Dubai or Caracas or somewhere. And so at the same time as I was getting ready to do the Rock and Roll Circus, we were talking about what was going to be Let It Be. The Rock and Roll Circus was shot over 2 days, mainly 1 day of rehearsal and 1 full day of shooting.
And how many cameras did you use?
We had 5. The cameras were a problem because they had been imported from France because the French had come up with a way of you'd end up with film, so you had reels of film on the side of the camera, but they would also send images into a control room rather like in normal live television. So I could be in the control room and see the images and call out to the cameraman on their earphones, make the close-up, do this, do that. Whereas normally, when you were filming, you didn't really know what you were getting, because sometimes, especially in a live show, because the cameraman would be working their own and you'd put it together later. But the cameras kept breaking down. And so there were these lulls in the day's work when a French technician would come onto the studio floor with a screwdriver and open up the panel in the camera and do something and say, c'est bon, and then you'd start again. I wrote this memoir years ago called Luck and Circumstance, and there's something I had in the book which I remember very much to do with the cameras breaking down, that in one of these enforced lulls I went back to the dressing room, and in the dressing room where John Lennon Mick Jagger, Pete Townsend of The Who, Eric Clapton, and they all were playing, jamming Tamla Motown songs, old blues. Keith Moon of The Who was playing spoons on the table for the percussion. And I thought, this is sort of an encapsulation of what these times are like, that there were these young men who'd all ended up in London, but they come from different parts of England, the Stones and The Who basically in London, the Beatles and from Liverpool, but they'd ended up in London, and although they were rivals, I mean, each one wanted their single to be the single, they were also great friends because they were going through this experience together. And I thought what was going on in the room that day was the exemplar of all that was going on. And then The Who were great, and the rest of it was great. Marianne Faithfull was beautiful, and John Lennon was wonderful, singing Your Blues, I think, Your Blues. And then, because it had been a long day, and because we'd had all the breakdowns, the Rolling Stones didn't get on stage until 2 in the morning. And they'd been there since 11 in the morning, the day before. And they'd been hanging around for 13 hours, and some of them were a little less than steady, I suppose, and it was the last time Brian Jones ever played with them, and we were going toward like 5 o'clock in the morning, because we'd do one take of You Can't Always Get What You Want, and then the sound wouldn't be right, or the performance would be grinded out, and Parachute Woman, and this and that and the other, and so at about 5 in the morning, we were going to do the one we'd been waiting all day for, which is Sympathy for the Devil. And, but everyone was exhausted. The camera guys had had their eyes in the viewfinder for like 18 hours. And so there was a very straggly performance. And then we thought, well, maybe we better stop and come back the next day, but that was too much money to hold the studio, blah, blah, blah. And so I said to Mick, you know, if you got one more in you, and he said, I do, with the camera guys. So he went and talked to the Stones, I talked to the crew. And so there was one more performance of Sympathy for the Devil, which is 5 o'clock in the morning. And he was extraordinary. An extraordinary something he pulled out of himself with his enormous willpower and his enormous kind of showmanship and his extraordinary talent. And so we finished, we did one more song, Salt of the Earth, and it was done. And then the weird thing which happened was that we put together a rough cut, showed it to Mick and Keith in January, and they thought The Who were great, but they thought in comparison to The Who, because they'd gone on at 2 in the morning, because they were basically shot, that they didn't want, since it was called the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, they didn't want The Who to be the best guy in the show. So there were lots of plans to reshoot the Stones segment. At one point, we were going to, this set had been taken down. It wasn't a set anymore, so we couldn't go back to that. We couldn't get resurrected. And then we're going to do it in Rome in the Colosseum, the original circus. And then whoever was in charge of getting the permits from the city of Rome spent more time getting the popcorn and the balloon concessions sorted out. And we didn't have the permit, so we didn't do that. And in those days, if a rock and roll project lost momentum, it could be shelved. And the Stones went on tour. Brian left the group and then died a few months later. The Stones went on tour. Mick, I think, went to do a movie. And so time had gone by, and the circus was just sitting there in a rough cut stage. And we closed down the cutting room. And all the cans of film were taken to the Stones' office. But they changed offices from a big grand one into a small functional one. And so in this small two-room office were 30 cans of film, which were under the secretary's desk, in the bathroom, and Ian Stewart, who was their road manager, but much more than that, he originally played piano and stuff like that, was in the office one day, and he heard the girls there say, well, why don't we throw all this stuff out, throw this kinds of film out? And he thought, well, gee, maybe someday someone might. So he had his van outside, and he loaded the cans of film, 30 cans of film into his van, and drove them out to his place in the country. And over the years, because it was a defunct project, at least so often I'd say to him, whatever, where is the circus? I don't know. Because Stu hadn't told anybody, because he didn't think, he thought, well, I'll keep the cans of film, but no one seems to care about them. And so when he died prematurely, he's in his 40s, I think, his wife, he had a farm in the country, and his wife was going around the property, and she went into the barn. And in the barn, where there was bales of hay and old, you know, Wellington boots and a rake, there were these cans of film, you know, with the tape peeling off the side of them, saying "Rolling Stone, Auchinhall, Urquhart."
And how many years later?
Oh, this would be probably 12 years later, and no one had known. So it was really, as far as anyone knew, it was completely lost. Then the drums began to beat, and we found where it was, and then the cans of film went to Alan Klein, who, because of various deals with the Stones, he'd been their manager, and he retained certain rights, and he wasn't their manager anymore. And he's the one that was responsible, in a way, for getting the show re-edited and out there. And so Alan was, you know, central to the distribution of the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Service. But it was quite an adventure. We shot it in the end of 1968, finished shooting in December of 68. And its first public presentation was at the New York Film Festival in 1996. So it's 28 years later, the first time anybody saw it. And then it's, you know, people love it because you sort of see icons being born.
Mick Jagger in his prime,
Pete Townsend, The Who in their prime, John Lennon in his, one of his primes, he had several, and it's an extraordinary event which was captured on film, and because I luckily had the relationship I had with John and with the Rolling Stones, with The Who, because The Who were ready to go all the time, I knew how to shoot them, and also you'll see Mick performing very much close to the camera, and it's very intimate.
Very intimate. And I ask about the cameras because you don't have any sense that the cameras are even there, really.
No, you don't. And so it really is like you're almost a voyeur in this sensational event with these extraordinary people, I think.
I didn't see a credit for the art director. I wondered because the audience all dressed in their yellow and orange ponchos.
Well, I was the art director in the sense of that. I knew it'd be a long day. And I knew that, you know, the audience is made up of various people, the Rolling Stones fan club, friends, mutual. We probably could fit in about 200. But I knew I knew some bodies would fall by the wayside because it was going to be for, you know, I knew it was going to be over 14 hours. And so I thought, well, if you have someone behind, close with Pete Townsend, and then you come back and you're on a retake and the person has changed, it might be distracting for the viewer. And so then I had this idea, and I thought it would be nice to look at, that we could get these colorful ponchos and little felt hats. They were sort of felt, you know, cheap material ponchos, in orange or yellow or some sort of bright color. And so they had these little hats and they had these ponchos. And it was really, the practical reason was you wouldn't notice the audience was changing. But it did have the effect of giving a very nice palette.
It's a wonderful piece, actually. And partly, of course, because it's you see that period in its original glory.
In its original glory. And it was a glorious time because these people were changed society. I mean, they changed it to do with certainly looks, because when I was growing up, and when indeed they were growing up, it was much more, you know, people would go to work. The camera guys were still wearing ties and jackets, and here are you and I, you're wearing jeans now, and I'm wearing some old black pants with a lot of paint on them. So they changed fashion, they changed hair. Hair was allowed to have a sexual component again. Because I read that when the dictatorship took over in Greece or somewhere in the 70s, they did a couple things. They banned Playboy magazine, and they banned long hair. Because both, I suppose, were related to sexuality, and sexuality can be anarchic. And of course, if you're a dictator, the last thing you want is anything to do with anarchy. So they changed that, but they also changed the sort of temper of the world. Like, I'm sure they brought such a jolt of joy and excitement into the world, that period of rock and roll. And I'm convinced that one of the reasons the Beatles had such an extraordinary first appearance in America, they did the Sullivan Show in 64, was President Kennedy had been murdered in November 63, and America was a grieving country, as was the world. Then the Beatles appeared on Sullivan in, I think, early February 64, and I don't think anyone expected to, so soon after the president had been killed, experience joy again. And the Beatles represented joy and good times and everything. And then also, to do with the lyrics and stuff they could write about, these young men were having life experiences which were very different to what other young men had had prior. That is to say, they were traveling a lot, they were making some money, they were meeting lots of young women, alias groupies, and also the pill had come along only, the contraceptive pill had come along only a couple of years earlier, I think. And so, like, when the Rolling Stones wrote the song The Last Time, it was about the last time that the singer is seeing his girlfriend in some place, because I'll be gone a long, long time. It's the last time, meaning I'm going to be on the road, I'm going to meet other people, I'll have something to do with them. And it was a whole different way of writing. I don't mean just so much the lyrics, but they were able to write and discuss things in their music. If you think of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Bob Dylan, and The Who, which hadn't been something that could have been done or was being done, you know, 5 or 8 years earlier. So they did change society. So therefore, in the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Service, going back to your comment, is these were extraordinary people. I've often thought they reminded me, it reminded me the time of France, 100 years or so before, 1850, 1860, 1870, when a lot of people ended up in Paris. Some were from Paris, but some were from Le Havre, like Monet, some were from the north of France, the south of France, but for the most part, they ended up in Paris. And they formed a movement, which was early on scorned and rebuffed and reviled. And they were the Impressionists. And the Rock and Rollers were the Rock and Rollers. And they both were kind of electric sparks in society.
Now, as far as the Let It Be movie, that went right along and got released, right?
Well, it did. The Let It Be, we shot for a month. But it was also a tricky time because the Beatles were not getting on particularly. And they were starting, as I might say earlier, they were starting to go their own ways. George particularly was feeling constrained, I think, because previously with the Beatles, that you'd have, let's say you have 12 tracks on an album, 10 would be written by Lennon McCartney, one would be with Ringo, so he gets that bit of royalty, and then, you know, one or maybe two would be George Harrison songs. And George knew that he was soon, at some point, going to go out on his own and become the extraordinary songwriter that he was. And I think he was chafing at what he felt was the heavy thumb of Lennon and McCartney. There's a story that when they all were young in Liverpool, that George would be the one who would be carrying the guitar cases while Lennon and McCartney strode on ahead of him discussing all the great plans. And so he had been treated as a young one. He was the younger one. He was 14 when Paul was 15, John was 16. And he was ready to go out on his own. So at one point during the shooting of Let It Be, he quit. He walked out. And there'd been, I think in the movie, there's a sequence, those people who've seen it, is a memorable sequence when he and Paul seem to be having a little tiff or an argument about how to play something. And George says to him, I'll play what you want or I won't play at all. You just tell me, I'll do what you want. In other words, he was sort of stepping back, I don't care anymore. So he quit, which made things grind to a halt for a few days. And then he came back, but he came back with a couple of provisos. One was that we leave Twickenham Film Studios, which we would begun filming, which was a big soundstage, to go on recording in their basement studio at their building, their Apple building in Savile Row in London. That was one thing. Two is that any talk of a television special, which is what the original idea of Let It Be was, would be scrapped and we wouldn't do a television special. So they would just make an album and go back to the way they were used to doing, because George was the one who most of that period didn't want to perform anymore. It all got too crazy. You know, like when they finished touring in 66, they were in San Francisco, I think, and someone, you know, did a swan dive off the second balcony in the stadium they were in. And so it's too crazy. And originally, like I said, it was going to be a television special. And just a couple of days before we started shooting, McCartney had the idea that we film the rehearsals so that the television special would go out whatever date, and the week before there'd be like a half an hour intimate thing of the Beatles rehearsing, because no one had ever been with them rehearsing before. So George says no TV special, but we still have these two cameras which we've had for 2 weeks now, recording what's been going on all the time. And I also, because I think it was around this time, I was getting a sense that something might be wrong with the Rock and Roll Circus to do with the Rolling Stones thinking the Who had been better, and knowing, because I've been involved with other rock and roll things, that if something lost momentum, it might just disappear, because these people were used to being able to move quickly from one thing to another, and so if they lost interest, the thing could founder. And I didn't want that, because I knew that caught so many interesting moments to do with the Beatles, how they rehearsed, how they worked together, how they interacted. And I thought that we needed something to aim at, some sort of conclusion. And so one day we were having lunch, and they had this building, as I say, in Savile Row, which is a very elegant street in London, which is mainly the street where all the fashionable tailors have their shops. And lunch with them wasn't just, you know, someone would go and get a pizza. It was they had in their walk-through top second floor, they had a conference room, a dining room, and there were young sort of trainee chefs, you know, young women who cook you roast potatoes, chicken and stuff, whatever you want for lunch, red wine, white wine, macrobiotic for John and Yoko. And I had this idea of maybe conclusion that would be a good way to end the movie, or whatever it was going to be. I mean, it wasn't going to be a TV special. End the movie. And so we were having lunch Saturday, I think, and I said, I have an idea. And they said, what? And I said, we should do a concert. And then George said, I don't want to do a concert. And I said, no, you don't have to travel anywhere. We just do it on the roof. And that got a little traction from Paul, because Paul was the most active in wanting the thing to have a life, because he wanted them to go on together, to keep working, and he thought albums and projects would keep them together. So after that lunch, we went up in the roof and looked at it, and looked out over London, and thought, this is Paul and Ringo and a few other people, the cameraman, Tony Richmond, and thought, well, maybe it could happen. And we were going to do it on a Thursday, but the clouds were too low, it was too gray. And then Friday was, I guess, the day we were going to do it. We had 11 cameras all set up on the roof and on the opposite roof and ready down in the street. And I put a two-way mirror in the foyer of the building so that if the police tried to bust it out, we could photograph them and they would have to photograph. And so I was all ready to go, and we had the sound system, so we'd go out in the streets and everything. And we gathered about noon, because we figured we'd hit the lunchtime cars and go on between 12:15 and 12:30. So we're standing in this little room under the roof, wooden staircase, old building. And I realized the project wasn't secure in that not all of them really wanted to do it. George said, what's the point? Ringo said, it's cold up there. It was a cold January day, and, you know, cold day. And then Paul said, you know, come on, you've got to do something sooner. Come on, fellas. And he was trying to encourage them, but underneath his encouragement was something very steely, that we have to do this, we have to get together, do something together. Because Paul is a very, he's a very strong person. And he if he thinks something's right, he'll really fight for it. But at that time, there was two against him. There was George saying, what's the point? Ringo saying, it's cold. And then one voice had not been heard from. And then everyone kind of slid their eyes and looked at John. And then John said, fuck it, let's do it. And then Lennon McCartney outweighed Ringo and George. Because those two together were an unbeatable pair, as we know from the songwriting. And so they went up on the roof, and they played together for 40 minutes, which we edited down to 28 or something, because of the repetitions. And what was wonderful was when they were up there together playing to some sort of an audience, they knew they had the crowds in the street and everything like that, they were happy. It was a cold day, but they really played as a group, as a bunch of people who'd known each other since they were teenagers. And it was a really glorious occasion. And then John stepped to the mic when it was over and said, I'd like to thank you on behalf of ourselves and the group, and I hope we pass the audition. And of course, Fania never passed an audition. They did. And that was it. That was the last performance of the Beatles to any kind of audience. There was not like, you know, Frank Sinatra's retirement concerts, you know, where you have a dozen of them or whatever. But that was it. And that's what's on the film of Let It Be, which, as I say, I hope, I mean, Apple is going to release it. It's just a matter of they have various things that they release at various times to do with what they think will be the most opportune time. And I think Let It Be is going to come out, I mean, it's all ready to go. I mean, the movie's been, you know, washed, the sound has been buffed up. And there's a separate documentary about the making of the documentary, which I'm very happy about. Because stuff that I had to cut out of Let It Be is in the auxiliary piece. So it's going to come again. But they were both very interesting. I mean, they've had the Rock and Roll Circus, which was lost for a dozen years, and Let It Be, which has not been seen for, I don't know, 35 years. You know, it hasn't been easy. And of course, Let It Be has a kind of poignancy to it now, because we know what happened to John and George died. And so you see them in full flower making joy, but we see it with a kind of sadder heart now. When we shot, we're going to shoot, Paul and I discussed what we called the problem, which was the 3.5 or 4 minute chorus at the end, because they hadn't, well, they weren't performing live anymore. And so this was going to be the promotion for the song. And Paul and I thought, you know, shooting the Beatles for the verses would be fine. You know, people were dying to see the Beatles again. But if you were just on them for 4.5 minutes of la 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 la, you know, you had a danger, even with the Beatles, of testing the audience's patience. So we came up with this idea that we would have kind of the world come into the studio for the chorus. And so rather than just having, you know, kids in the fan club, we had housewives and the village postman and various people to illustrate the world, I suppose. And it turned out to be a successful video, because when it was shown, I think, in the Smothers Brothers show in America, the sales went from 40,000 a day to 60,000 a day, so they were happy with that. The shooting of Hey Jude led in to Let It Be, because between takes of Hey Jude, about 6 takes, I think. And when the cameras were repositioning and when the tapes in the video room were being reloaded, it was probably about 8 or 10 minutes at least between each take. And so the first break, people sort of stood there and had a cigarette and stuff. And then they realized there was this audience of 100 people hanging around. And their showbiz instincts kicked in, and they started to jam. They play some of their old songs. Everyone loved Tamla Motown, and they kind of enjoyed it, to their surprise, because they hadn't played to any kind of audience for at least 2 years once they stopped touring. And it was as a result of playing to those 100 people that led to McCartney pulling the others with him for a while anyway to have an idea we'd do a television special, which was the genesis of what became the Let It Be documentary. That they'd been playing, it was okay, the water was safe to put a toe in again, and they thought under controlled circumstance they could perform again in public. And it did. And that's how we ended up on the roof.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey,